Anything that can make it easier or better, amen and hallelujah, I say.
You are listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness, your number one resource for practical tips and insights, empowering you and your family to live well with Alzheimer's. Hello, I'm Mike Good of Togetherness. Welcome to episode 54 of the Alzheimer's Podcast, your number one source for practical tips and insights. My goal is always to empower you to maintain a positive experience, reduce and eliminate the need for medications, and make your time together with those you care for the best it can be. In this episode of Navigating Rough Terrain with the Dementia Sherpa, Christy Turner and I wrap up our three-part series on end of life with a conversation on the end of life specialist. If you missed our prior two episodes, be sure to check out episode 52 to learn tips on how to have a good death, and episode 53 on what are the things no one tells you about death. Christy, who has more than 16 years of experience in working with over 1,200 people living with dementia and their families, has also accompanied more than 23 people and their families as they transition through end of life. So Christy, why don't you start by just giving us an overview of the end of life specialist that we'll be discussing today?
Well, to my mind, end-of-life specialists is, if we just think about specialists like cardiology, endocrinology, internist, all of those different types of specialties, when it comes to end-of-life, that's where hospice comes in, because they are the end-of-life specialists. That's what they do. And yet it's a benefit that so many people don't know about, so they don't take advantage of it, or they're confused kind of about how it works and what the intricacies are. And then also, additionally, which may or may not be part of a hospice team, are end-of-life doulas. And I think we talked about that a little bit before, but they can also be a tremendous help and support. So I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of specifically what they do also.
That sounds great. On episode 14, I had a couple ladies come on and they talked about living with dying, and we had a really good episode on hospice and I learned a lot. So I'm looking forward to hearing it more about hospice and the end-of-life doulas from you today.
Well, episode 14 was great, so I'd encourage everybody to check that out if you haven't already. But I think that one of the most valuable things that a hospice team can provide for someone at the end of their life, and of course, we're talking about people living with dementia, so we'll kind of keep it specific to that, but it allows the family to be family again. So you get to be just the granddaughter, just the partner, just the, and it sounds like that's minimizing, but if you've ever experienced the loss of somebody that you love, it's a tremendous gift to be given permission to be in that role entirely and not have to worry about, is someone taking their medication or do they need X, Y, or Z, the physical needs that come at end of life too. Just like at any other point in life, there are still physical needs. And to have a team that is helping with that and kind of focusing on that allows you to really dial down on that emotional connection that you have with your person and to be fully present for their last stretch of life.
That does sound like an extremely valuable and important role. Now, can you just remind me, is hospice for the last, is it a 6-month window? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, so what they ask for is a diagnosis from a physician and the physician, of course, does not have a crystal ball, right?
Right.
So, and sometimes doctors can feel kind of pinned down by that, But if that's the case, you can always call hospice directly and ask them to get with the doctor and get the order. So what they're looking at is that the doctor's best guess is the person has 6 months or less left to live. The problem, I think, a lot is that, of course, it's tough for us, right, emotionally. So we don't really want to face this. We don't want to really acknowledge that this could be it. And so in the United States, I think the last stat I saw was somewhere around 7 days is the actual benefit that people end up taking advantage of. And here in Oregon, it's 17 days. And that's abysmal no matter what, right? When somebody could be benefiting from 6 months of extra TLC, when you as the care partner could be benefiting from 6 months of extra TLC because they're support to you also, and you're looking at 7 days or even 17 days, that's terrible. It's like robbing somebody of something that, you know, would be this huge emotional and physical benefit to them.
Wow, that is an incredible stat. That's so disappointing to hear in many ways.
I
kind of imagine also that sometimes the doctors are, because they don't have the crystal ball, are hesitant to refer a person to hospice.
Yeah, I had this experience in my own family with my grandma who had had, she, by the time she died, she had Alzheimer's for 19 years.
Wow.
And so it was a very clear case of disease progression, and her doctor was just not tuned in at all, and he had some kind of idea about how he was going to be held personally liable or responsible if he guessed wrong, which was, of course, not the case. That's not how it works. And just by virtue of the fact that I was a memory care director at the time and had, you know, a hospice team that I worked very closely with all the time, and their medical director, I knew I was able to ask for their intervention. I knew that I could ask for their intervention. Anybody can do that. So if one of our listeners, you know, has that situation where you've talked to the doctor about hospice and the doctor's like, well, no, I don't know. And you're going, really? Because I have eyes and I can see this is a serious, significant decline. You can always just call the hospice of your choice directly, ask them to talk to the primary care, to offer some education, to find out maybe what the objections are. They will intervene on your behalf. And the flip side of that is it may be that the doctor is correct and is seeing something that you're not able to see either because of the doctor's years of experience and training or because of, you know, maybe your emotional connection to your person. It's you want what's best for them, of course. And sometimes that can cloud our vision a little bit because we're coming from that place of I want what's best. And that might not be meeting hospice criteria. In that case, it's still a great idea to ask hospice to have that conversation. They can offer you more education. And then I think most hospices now also have what's called a palliative care program, where your person can be enrolled in that program, which is would be the step before hospice. And what that focuses on entirely is comfort care, comfort measures. So they just want to make your person as comfortable and happy as possible. And then when they are meeting hospice criteria, boom, they can just immediately be enrolled and because they're already in the system and it's a very smooth, easy process. So I would just encourage people to call the hospice of their choice and get the ball rolling that way. They can always let you know if it's not appropriate yet, kind of what timeline they're looking at, or they'll give you some ideas about things to watch for, like weight loss guidelines, repeated falls, things like that, that will help you plan a little better prepare a little better and give you some sense of control when at least you know, like, okay, this is a big deal, or this thing over here, not so much.
Do you have a tip to help our listeners find the best hospice for them?
Yeah, I do. So I think one thing that it's really important for people to know, because many people don't know this, is you have a choice in which hospice you use. So you may be part of a medical system that contracts with XYZ provider, and you actually can still have a choice. You need to have a conversation with the hospice of your choice, and they will guide you through that. As far as actually finding a hospice that you feel is a good fit, it's always a good idea to talk to friends or extended family that maybe have used a hospice that they really loved and can't speak highly enough of. You can also Google hospice and then your city, and it will give you a list of providers in your area. And another thing, and this might sound kind of weird, but you know, depending on how much time you have to do research or how much you like to dive into research, you can look in the obituaries in your local paper, because often families will thank the hospice that they've used in their person's obituary, because that, and I think that also speaks to how valuable a service it is. When the family's like, oh, be sure to mention this specific hospice because they were so amazing.
Well, I would never have thought of that, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I'm still hung up a little on the 7 and 17 day stat, because what I learned from the ladies was a misconception I had about hospice was that it was really only for bedridden people, but really the intent was, a lot of the intent of hospice and then even more palliative care, I imagine, is to help that family and the loved one get out of the house and enjoy their last days together.
Yeah, I think it really depends on kind of what physical condition someone is in,
right,
and what their preferences are. And this is a great segue right into talking about end-of-life doulas. And so we talked a little bit about that in a previous episode, but what they do is really help you dial down on what do you want this to look like? What do you want this experience to be in those last days and last hours? And so for some people, maybe especially for us Oregonians, being in the sun, being in the garden in the sun might be just a wonderful experience. For someone else, they might be at a point where they have already sort of transitioned into a more inward, trying to come up with the right phrase. They're not so concerned with their exterior environment. They have turned their attention inward and they're doing work inside. And so the exterior, like being in the sun or in a certain place, may not matter as much. So
when you say interior, you mean like more spiritually, more of their inner person?
Spiritual. Thank you.
Okay.
Spiritual. That was it, Mike. You got it.
All right.
But again, this is where an end-of-life doula really helps with guiding you through, you know, XYZ is likely to happen, ABC, maybe not so much, but talking about kind of, you know, and I think it was our last episode where we talked about things that, you know, nobody really tells you. And I don't know if we mentioned this specifically, but that is something that is very normal that happens, is where people turn inward, right? And they're, it seems to be more spiritual work rather than much concern with the environment around them. That said, you know, environment is important. We talked about that in you know, kind of what a good death might look like, as far as music or aromatherapy or whatever it might be. End-of-life doulas will help. They call it a vigil plan. So in those last days, last hours, it's kind of mapped out for people in advance. So when it can start to feel awkward for people who want to be present but don't want to be intrusive, or people who maybe have never been in the presence of a dying person before, or who want to support the family but aren't sure the best way to do that, that vigil plan covers things like that. Like, it might say something like, if my dog wants to come in and be on the bed, by all means, you know, put him on the bed if he's showing an interest, or something like that, that the person may not be able to communicate when they are right there at the end of their life. So I think that's really helpful, because I think that most of us, you know, we come from a place of having a big heart, and we're full of love for our person. We want to do everything that we can. And if there are just so many things that can happen at the end of life that we didn't anticipate, or we just didn't think about because that hasn't been our focus, and now we're in that situation and unsure what to do. And especially if we're, you know, let's say it's your grandparent, right? And so you want to support not only your grandparent, but your parents in that. How do you do that? What does that look like? And again, this is where an end-of-life doula just can be invaluable. And they work with hospice. Some have volunteer end-of-life doulas as part of hospice service. Others don't. But you can always just privately hire an end-of-life doula to assist with all of that.
So is there an association that the end-of-life doulas are like part of that you can contact? Or is it best for our listeners to find an end-of-life doula through a hospice or palliative care?
So because there are various certification programs, I can't recommend just like, hey, go to this one central place. Again, this is where Google is your friend, and asking at the hospice. And it's important to know too that, as you can imagine, I think from the way I've described them, end-of-life doulas are pretty popular. So finding a volunteer end-of-life doula through a hospice service, typically they are going to be in very high demand. And they're going to be prioritized according to the highest need. Right. So those who are closest to death, whereas you can, to really take full advantage of an end-of-life doula, ideally you'd want to establish that relationship in advance. Now, when we're talking about people only being on hospice service for 7 days, that's not much time. But, you know, if you're able to recognize the signs and are a little bit more proactive, you can find a service, let's say 6 months in advance, and kind of have conversations that don't feel as pressed for time, as urgent, and to have a little bit more time to think more clearly about what you'd like this experience to look like for your person. So again, I always go back to Google. End of life doula plus your city, and a popular search in Google is actually called death doula and then your city, and it will pop up all kinds of resources for you.
So Christy, one of the huge misconceptions I had about hospice was I had this image that they were always there 24/7, but I believe that's not a correct assumption. Is that right?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Mike, because that's true. They do not provide 24-hour care. And that is something that if people were counting on that, that's a rude surprise. So in-home care can provide 24-hour care if you need that. But that is a separate thing altogether. Whereas, again, they would coordinate with the hospice team. And the hospice team would be able to give you a good idea as far as, like, the personal care needs that your person has. And if you're kind of wondering, like, well, how much care should I have? And does it need to be around the clock? And they can definitely help you with figuring that out. But what the hospice team is comprised of is a nurse whose visits are going to be more frequent as your person gets closer to the end of her life, CNA or certified nursing assistant, and likewise, those visits will increase as your person gets closer to the end of her life. And that person can definitely do personal care. But for example, if your person is incontinent, they're going to need more than just those routine CNA visits, right? That's going to be a round-the-clock situation. So that would be a specific example of where in-home care would be necessary unless you're doing that yourself. But a CNA can do things like nail care, pedicures, bathing, and that doesn't mean like in a shower. They can do amazing bed baths, things like that, do hair. And then, okay, so the team is the nurse, the CNA. There's also a social worker and a chaplain. So you're going to see the social worker and the chaplain not as frequently. The chaplain more frequently, but the social worker typically not very much. And then some teams also have, and this depends on the hospice service, so kind of look for what's important. I have a strong volunteer program where, for example, like in my grandma's case that I was talking about earlier, there was a wonderful woman named Laura who was a volunteer with that program, and she would come in and read to my grandma for an hour every week. And just, she had such a soothing voice and would just read out of my grandma's favorite books. And my parents would go to lunch at a nearby place. And so they just had that like 55 minutes together. And that was a great experience. Or a chaplain might come in and play the guitar or sing or pray or just visit, you know, kind of depending on what the person wants. They might have a pet therapy program or music therapy. I've worked with some wonderful hospices over the year that have a harpist, which is just so soothing. It's right. Amazing. Yeah. So there are just lots of different options. It's just a good thing to, when you go to a hospice website, you can kind of see all the different services that they offer.
I can really see why it'd be so important to try to start this relationship and research early so that you can know what questions to ask and what features and services to look for so that you can have your expectations set and, you know, be planned, you know, and avoid that chaos and all the emotional, negative emotions that come from being under that stress.
Right, because you got to remember, as a dementia care partner, you've been trying as best you can to manage this situation for years already, right? So you are probably feeling it. You're a little worn down. Then when you have someone who is at the end of their life, that's an additional stressor to you. And anything that can make it easier or better, amen and hallelujah, I say. I mean, jump on board with that. Plus, it is a Medicare benefit. So your person is entitled to this. Take advantage.
And I can see how important that would be to, like, if someone can have someone like you helping them long before this need comes up, because you can see down the road because you've been down this road several times, and you can help them know it's coming and help them prepare and accept the fact that they need to go down this path now and get their, you know, things in order and find the right people to help them through this time of need as well. So
that's true. And, you know, I think that it is always, and professionals say this all the time, it's different when it's your own family. Mm-hmm. But I had that experience with a client that I was guardian for. So it was like an elder adoption. And I had a conversation with her primary care about when I thought like hospice might be appropriate. And he said, you know, he apologized to me and said, I'm sorry. I missed that. You know, you're right. Let's go ahead and make the referral. Did that. She was on service for, I think it was maybe a month, 2 months maybe. And then she was dropped from service because that extra TLC, she was like a little wilting flower that got some extra sun and water, and she perked up and she was great. Well, then, I don't know, 6 months later or so, we were in the doctor's office for a follow-up appointment. And the doctor said to me, you know, Christy, it's time to call hospice again. And I went, what? There had been so many good days, you know, kind of a string of good days. I missed it because I was so emotionally involved in that period. I missed it entirely. And thank God the doctor saw it. So it is good to have a professional and to establish those relationships. So there's that trust there where, you know, you can speak very honestly to each other and forthrightly and not miss turning points.
I know a girl that has worked in hospice for 20 something years, and I've watched her give several classes on it. And she told me that when her mom was passing away and she got on the plane and was going there, she forgot everything she'd been teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So like you said, when you're close to it, you need somebody else there to help guide you through it.
Yeah.
If someone's on hospice and then they go off of hospice and they come back onto hospice, does it start over? Are they prorating their months?
No, that is a great question. So I have actually had people that were on it for a total of 3 years or two years or whatever, just off and on, off and on, off and on, because of, like I said, that perking effect that it can have.
Right.
And it's not like you're limited to 6 months ever. And whoops, we thought this was it. And now too bad when it is. It does not work like that. So that is a great question. So what happens is if someone meets the guidelines for service, they're picked up for service. And then the team is looking at them. And it's called a recertification. And so the team will let you know when recertification is coming up and the criteria that needs to be met for recertification to happen. And they will typically give you a heads up, like, okay, recertification is happening. If your person is continuing down this track as they have been, and they'll tell you, it looks like recertification isn't going to be a problem, or it looks like recertification may not happen. If that's the case, we'll just transfer them over to palliative care. And of course, they're watching closely. When they're appropriate for service again, we'll just pick them right back up.
Okay. Christy, the last question I'd like to ask you today is, so hospice can be in your own home, but yep. I'm also aware that, for instance, my wife helped do some design at a hospice that was being built inside of a residential home. They took a home that was in suburbia and they converted into a hospice home. So hospice can also be at these other locations. Is that normal throughout the country, I guess?
Right. So hospice homes, unfortunately, I love them. There's one here in Portland that I cannot say enough good things about, because the location is amazing. The courtyard is spectacular. It's all just great. But typically hospice homes are for people who are very close.
Okay.
And so the benefit only covers a very limited stay there. So that's one thing that I never want to discourage anybody, but that's something you're going to need to talk to your hospice team about, see if they even have one. And then it does have, Medicare has very strict criteria for coverage. So don't kind of plan on in your head, like, oh, that's what will happen. So usually what happens is hospice service is delivered wherever someone lives. So that could be in your home, in their home, in a nursing home, assisted living, memory care, under a bridge, in a car. Doesn't matter where someone lives, as long as hospice, you know, can find them, right? And they're on service and they don't move around, hospice will come to them and care for them.
All right. Well, Christy, I thank you for talking to us and to me and our listeners today about hospice and end-of-life doulas. And is there any last tidbit or thought you want to share before we wrap up?
I would just say I know that sometimes we can hear an idea that maybe we haven't thought a lot about, or talking about death can be very uncomfortable for a lot of people. And so we kind of get some resistance to it and dismiss it out of hand. I would just really encourage people to reach out, find a hospice or end-of-life doula or both near you, and make some phone calls and just get the information for yourself and I think that you'll be really pleasantly surprised if this is an idea that you've kind of been resistive to. You'll be really pleasantly surprised at how amazing it is.
Okay, Christy. Well, thanks again, and I look forward to talking with you next week.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. This concludes our conversation with Christy Turner, the Dementia Sherpa, right here on the Alzheimer's Podcast, your number one source for practical tips and insights. If you missed our prior two episodes, be sure to check out episode 52 and to learn tips on how to have a good death, and episode 53 on what are the things no one tells you about death. And if you would like to see the show notes for any mentioned resources or links, be sure to visit togetherinthis.com/episode54. I look forward to having you back next week when Christy and I discuss long-distance caregiving. Bye now. You've been listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness. For more information and to get the resources mentioned in this episode, visit togetherinthis.com/podcast.